Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the recent news that Michael Flynn is presumably cooperating with Robert Mueller, and we'll be presented with a roadmap of the Mueller investigation and explore the follow the money strand, the political operative strand, and the digital Kushner, Bannon, Mercer strand that will likely coalesce into a conclusion by the special counsel to recommend the impeachment of President Trump if Trump does not fire Mueller first to try to shut down the inquiry. Stephen Harper, a professor at Northwestern University who blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has an article at Bill Moyers at BillMoyers.com, the Trump-Russia story is coming together. Here's how to make sense of it, joins us. Having produced timelines and a map with over 700 entries of the entangled ties between Putin and Trump and the murky world of Russian oligarchs, state officials, hackers, spies, and Republican operatives, Stephen Harper will discuss how everything that Trump, his cabinet, his campaign, and his complicit GOP Congress has said about connections and collusion between Trump and Russia is a lie. Then, with the upcoming week, the crucial test of whether the Republican senator will pass their version of the so-called tax reform bill, we'll get an analysis of what we know about it so far from economist James Galbraith, the chair of government business relations and a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He joins us to discuss the Republican race to get something passed before voters notice how damaging this obscene gift to the super-rich donors at the expense of the middle class will be to the average American, coupled with the pressure on Republican lawmakers to get any legislation passed, no matter how disastrous it will be for the American people and the economy. Then finally, we'll look into the slaughter in the Sinai that has outraged the Egyptian people and exposed the central fraud of General Sisi's military dictatorship, revealing that a military government cannot even provide basic security for its citizens. Sema Shahata, a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt, joins us to discuss the blowback from the worst bloodshed of its kind in modern Egyptian history, resulting from the ISIS attack on a Sufi mosque in the northern Sinai that killed over 300 worshippers, including 27 children. And joining us now is Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He is the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story. He blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has an article with Bill Moyers at BillMoyers.com, The Trump-Russia Story is Coming Together. Here's how to make sense of it. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Harper.
Well, thank you for the generous and kind words, Ian. I appreciate happy to be here.
Well, thank you. And I thank you for the work you've done, because it is a tangled web. Oh, what tangled webs we weave when first we practice to deceive. And you've got over 700 entries here, a map and a timeline, which I guess, film directors and screenwriters do this when they're trying to work out a movie plot line. So you've sort of worked out this plot line.
And I would add to that, so do trial lawyers. In my career, really, I've been an adjunct faculty at Northwestern for 20 years, teaching trial advocacy and professional responsibility. But my breadwinning career was as a trial lawyer, where what I had to do was really master very complex cases, industries, and so forth, and try to distill them in a way that you could make sense of them, first to myself and then second to a jury, because ultimately it doesn't matter what you have in your head. If you can't convince the trier of fact that there's a narrative that makes sense, it all kind of falls apart. And you're right, we're up somewhere around 800 entries. When I started this thing, the timeline that is at BillMoyers.com back in late January, we had two dozen entries, and it was really just part of my effort to say, look, readers, pay attention to what's happening, because there's a real story here involving Russia. And I just had what at that point were really, I thought, 24 highlight points that since then have now evolved into literally 800 separate entries on the timeline. I would call it a labor of love, but it's more a labor born of fear. because it just, you know, you become fearful for, frankly, the fate of democracy when you start to put a lot of these different, as you correctly noted in your introductory remarks, the various what I think are strands as they begin to coalesce and form a fairly coherent narrative. But you have to be willing to sort of sift through it all to get to that process of distillation.
Well, of course, the shoe that dropped this week is the revelation that Michael Flynn, the short-lived national security advisor, is likely cooperating with Mueller, and his lawyers are no longer talking to Trump's lawyers. That, of course, is significant. And Flynn, of course, was the first person that Trump tried to shut down the investigation of Mike Flynn. That's what the purpose of his meeting with Comey, which Comey revealed in his testimony. And my sense is that there's a sort of personal subtext here to some extent. Who's left in this country to defend democracy, as you just pointed out? It's under threat. The Republicans are just shameless. They're absolutely despicable in their complicity and their silence, except for a couple of notable people like Bob Corker and Jeff Flake. So what's it come down to save America from Trump and his Russian cohorts?
Well, I guess, as in all things, it comes down to the people, because, you know, and what you say is precisely correct. And the thing that has really astonished me more than anything else, I'm not astonished that Trump has continued really from the outset to do everything he could to minimize, defeat, block, stop the investigation, obstruct it really in every way, in any way that he can. But I have really been surprised in a very unpleasant way at the ongoing complicity of the GOP. It's, I guess, they're just all locked into their short-term agendas, and as long as they have anyone, literally, you could say anyone who can sign a pen that, you know, that will authorize legislation that they pass as part of their short-term agenda, then they're willing to sacrifice democracy in the process of doing that. I've just been astonished. I think if you'd taken a poll of Americans, and even if you'd taken a poll, I think, of American Republicans who said, and you would ask them on the day after the election, what would you think and how would you respond if it turned out that the Russia investigation became sufficiently serious that within a matter of months, Trump would have fired the FBI director after trying to pressure him into shutting the investigation down? What would your response to that would have been? And I have to believe at that point people would have said, you've got to be kidding me, he'll never do that. But we've gone through this incremental process of eroding, you know, norms that have really made us a civilized democracy for a long time. And without those norms, I think the republic is really in peril. And I'm not a person who's given to hyperbole, but you ask, you know, what saves us now? And I think in many, many ways, the fate of the country is in the hands of Robert Mueller, and I am confident that he knows that, and you just have to hope that against hope that Trump's next move, you know, won't be to some way figure out a way to fire Mueller and shut the whole thing down, issue pardons to anybody who would otherwise be a target, and just say, there, you know, it was all fake news, it was all a hoax, told you so. But the good news, I think, is that Mueller is moving, you know, relative to historical standards, he's moving extremely quickly for a special prosecutor. You know, the Whitewater thing was around for 8 years. It took 2 years into Watergate before Richard Nixon finally resigns. And we already have with Mueller two indictments as well as a guilty plea confession that really goes in many ways to the heart of what was happening during the campaign. It certainly adds to the guilty plea confession, I think it does, and continues to reach higher ups. The Flynn thing will be an interesting thing to watch to see how that develops.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster Story. He blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has an article with Bill Moyers at billmoyers.com, The Trump-Russia Story is Coming Together. Here's how to make sense of it. My sense, though, is that Comey was in a unique position, having witnessed attempts to squash the Flynn investigation, and essentially this kind of mafia type approach that Trump made to him. Which he revealed in his testimony that basically Comey was deeply uncomfortable about basically being asked to basically pledge loyalty to the Godfather, if you will.
Right, kiss the ring and get a TV show on Fox. It seems is the
I think what's happening here is that Comey, of course, is close to Mueller. Comey, I think, may even be expiating for the disastrous intervention at the in the election that. Hillary Clinton claims cost her the presidency. My sense is that probably at the end of the day, if Trump doesn't shut it down preemptively, which he's very likely to do, as you point out, will be that Mueller has a very thorough report that's unequivocal, and then at the end of which will be the recommendation to impeach Trump. But then what happens then?
Well, there are two aspects. There's even a catch before we get to the Mueller report getting released. He certainly will prepare one. But then it becomes up to whoever is supervising the investigation at that point to decide whether or not to release it, and then if to release it, to whom. And you've got a lot of potential slips between the cup and the lip in terms of who will wind up ultimately making that decision. If it were today, the decision would fall to Rod Rosenstein. If for some reason Sessions is no longer the Attorney General, then you're in the terrible predicament of Trump being able to appoint whoever he wants as acting Attorney General, who would then take over for Rosenstein, and at that point it could be Mueller's report could be buried. But you raise the next question, which is, okay, so let's assume, number one, that Mueller finds criminal wrongdoing sufficient to create an issue, and that's really the thing that people lose sight of too. If there's something that's just wrong or immoral or nefarious or sinister, that isn't alone enough. It has to cross the threshold of criminal wrongdoing in order for Mueller to decide it's something that he needs to take a close look at in terms of indictment. So you could have something that is horrible to anyone looking at it, but if it doesn't reach the threshold of criminality, it doesn't really remain on Mueller's screen. But your question is the right question to ask, which is, and it's one that I hope strategically people who are concerned about the future of democracy pay close attention to, which is, what happens? Let's assume you get through all of the hurdles that we've now identified, you and I, and you get to a point where it's in the, the report is out, it's in the public domain. What happens next? The ball bounces to the Republican House of Representatives, or if it's after 2018 and the Democrats have taken over, it bounces to a democratically controlled House of Representatives, where presumably there would be hearings on whether or not there should be articles of impeachment that should issue from the House. But then, even if that happens, you have the specter of having to get two-thirds of the Senate to agree to convict Trump in order to impeach him and remove him from office. Now, hidden and sort of to the side of all of this is the prospect that people are beginning to talk about a little bit, certainly in academic and scholarly circles are talking about it, and that is the prospect of actually indicting a sitting president. Obviously, it's never happened. It's not clear whether it's possible or not. You can certainly indict a sitting president. What's less clear is whether you can try him while he's in office. You could indict him and then he gets tried after he's no longer in office. But it gets very complicated, but at the end of the day, it boils down to a pretty simple solution. Will people who are who call themselves Republicans also call themselves patriots and be willing to take a cold, hard look at what I am convinced will be an objective view from Mueller about what it is that has happened here? And that's an important question that I think the fate of the country will hinge upon.
Well, what we know so far from Comey would indicate that there is some the possibility of obstruction of justice.
Yes.
But do you have to prove that what was being obstructed is a crime?
No. You can obstruct justice as George Papadopoulos, the fellow who confessed and pled guilty, acknowledged. What he wound up pleading guilty to was lying to federal investigators. Now, the next question is, what was he lying to federal investigators about? And the answer is, he was lying about the Trump campaign's connections to Russia. and contacts to Russia. So, you know, the White House's initial spin on the whole Papadopoulos plea agreement, guilty plea agreement, was, you know, he didn't get into any trouble for anything he did. He got in trouble for lying to federal investigators, and nobody should ever do that, glossing over the fact that what he lied to federal investigators about was the nature of the Trump campaign contacts to Russia. Now, the question is, what else? And there are a number of bases that you could think of that could lead to criminal wrongdoing with respect to the nature of those contacts with Russia. You could be involved, if you were involved in, for example, actively promoting and disseminating or aiding and abetting or part of a conspiracy to distribute stolen, hacked documents from the DNC. That would be a computer-related crime. You could have a situation where if you were accepting help from a foreign government in order to help win an election, you would be in violation of campaign finance laws. But you can obstruct justice by simply lying when a federal investigator, whether it's congressional or Robert Mueller as special counsel or the FBI, asks you questions and you lie to them about it. And that's sufficient to get you to obstruction of justice, wholly apart from the question of what you're lying about.
Well, there are, of course, as you point out, these moments where so much happens that would indicate a couple of key dates. Of course, the June meeting in Trump Tower being one. A month after that, the WikiLeaks data dump happens. Donald Trump, when Junior says, when he's told about what the Russians are going to provide at this meeting, if you have what you say you have in terms of dirt on Clinton, I love it. Well, a month later, the data dump happened of the DNC hacked. It's hard not to be suspicious.
And roughly simultaneously with the Republican, with the successful effort by the Trump campaign to weaken the Republican Party platform plank on Ukrainian sanctions over Crimea. You know, you always look for the quid pro quo in all of this, and that's where you kind of get into the strands that you alluded to, which is the follow the money trail. And you're right, there are moments, and that's sort of the value of the timeline, I think, in the timeline exercise, where you can actually look at a particular day or look at several days and say, okay, well, what was happening around this time? Because the difficulty with the way much of the information has dribbled out, and frankly, some of the way in which the media has covered it, is that they don't provide readers or listeners with anything that gives them context to the specific event that happens. If all of this stuff had dribbled out in a coherent narrative at the same time, it would be a simple story. People would look at it and they'd say, "Are you kidding me? There are all these connections with WikiLeaks. Wait, you mean when Trump said that there had been no contacts with his campaign, there actually had been 31? You mean when he said there'd been no meetings, there had actually been 19? Wait a minute. You know, but the stuff has dribbled out in such a fashion that I think, you know, Americans kind of become I don't know if hardens the right word. You just sort of become numb to it all.
Right. Well, of course, the hot date that you refer to in June, the meeting, Jared Kushner was in that meeting, but also what coincided with that date was when Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, hired Cambridge Analytical to do the digital campaign. And as we know, there was pressure put on Facebook to get rid of the human curation of their news, since 3/4 of Americans get their news from Facebook, and Zuckerberg folded and got rid of the human curation and then brought in the algorithms, and immediately Cambridge Analytica were able to game those algorithms and all the Russian fake news amplified with their bots and troll farms. And that was a big factor in the victory of Donald Trump.
Go ahead.
The other hot date, of course, is later, October the 12th. So walk us through that one as well. We only got a couple of minutes left here.
Sure, that's a great one. October 12th, you know, we have these email exchanges in September and October between Don Jr. and WikiLeaks. Those surfaced just recently. And on October 12th, you know, Roger Stone, longtime Trump confidant, is telling NBC that he has back-channel communications with WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks sends a private message to Don Jr. suggesting that Trump publicize the Clinton documents from WikiLeaks, and lo and behold, 15 minutes later, Trump obliges. And then 2 days after that, Don Jr. tweets the URL link, the very URL link that WikiLeaks had asked him to put out there. So who was it, Emma Bull, who said, coincidence is the word we use when we can't see the levers and pulleys. That's an awful lot happening in a very short period of time on a single day that sure looks peculiar.
Well, the timeline is available where again? We've got to...
BillMoyers.com is the best place to find it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm grateful for anyone, particularly you. It's such a pleasure to come to encounter someone who's so fully up on the facts that it reassures me that there's hope for us.
Well, it's the thing that's frustrating about this story is that on the right, Republicans, the Cold Warriors, etc., and red baiters, they're all in denial about it, and then on the left, you've got people like the editors of the Nation magazine and others basically saying that there's no there, and where's the proof? And that's, of course, the line from RT, Russia Today. And this whole story begins with Guccifer hacking into Sid Blumenthal's email, which is a soft spot, which is how intelligence operations operate.
Yep.
They, through hacking into Sid Blumenthal, they discover Hillary's private server. And, of course, that became a massive issue in the campaign. And then RT, Russia Today, then goes publicizes the existence of Hillary's server as in the public interest, as they say. So that's how it all began. And it's been a tangled web ever since. So let's stay on top of it, and I'd like to be back in touch with you.
I'd be happy to talk to you anytime. Anytime I can get an ear, I'm happy to talk about this for as long as people are willing to listen to me.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Harper. He's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including The Lawyer Bubble, A Profession in Crisis, and Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster Story. He blogs at Belly of the Beast and has an article at BillMoyers.com with Bill Moyers, The Trump Russia Story is Coming Together. Here's how to make sense of it. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Senate tax reform bill that will be the subject of a lot of attention this coming week. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Galbraith, the Chair of Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas Inequality Project and is the author of Inequality and Instability, a Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis, and Welcome to the Poison Chalice, the Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Thank you very much.
And it seems that what's going to be happening next week with the Senate looking into or debating, although the Democrats are pretty much shut out of it, and this is frankly not how business is done, as John McCain himself has said many times, let's go back to regular order. They're obviously rushing this thing through They want to get something passed, to my mind, because before voters notice what an obscene gift to the super-rich donors this is at the expense of the middle class. But you also have to couple this with pressure on Republican lawmakers to get any legislation passed, no matter how disastrous it will be for the American people and the economy. That seems to be what we're dealing with here.
Well, you've summarized it for me. This is a Republican bill for Republican donors, and that's about the size of it. It is going through on a fast track, and it's pretty clear that it will be a significant tax increase for many middle-class families, particularly those with large families, those with children who will lose the personal exemption. It's a kind of a remarkable thing that this is being done with such speed at this moment.
But is there also not a petty kind of partisan tinge to it, basically attacking blue states who have successful economies and who contribute more to the red states than the red states contribute to the federal budget?
Well, it will be a major bite on New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and California, states with relatively high income taxes who currently are able to deduct their state local income taxes from their federal tax bill. That will go away under the bill. So, yes, the states with high income taxes, which are also states which have major infrastructure requirements, will be hit. States with relatively high property values will be hit by the loss of the mortgage interest deduction. So those, yes, it is targeted very strongly on states that on a few states that especially did not vote Republican in the last election.
So if three senators, Republican senators, jump ship, then it's a repeat of the failure of to repeal and replace Obamacare, and clearly a bad signal for Republicans entering the 2018 election year that they can't govern. Obviously, that's the pressure that I was mentioning in the beginning. What's your sense then?
I think that indicates that it's quite likely that this bill will pass.
Mm-hmm.
Because whereas when they defeated the repeal of Obamacare, it was not at that time make or break for the whole Republican brand. I think there's a substantial perception that this is make or break for the Republican brand, and that perception is especially held by the campaign donors who want the bill. So I suspect that it will be harder to get the three votes in the Senate to sink this thing than it was to rally sufficient votes to prevent the repeal of health insurance for millions of Americans.
And Senator Lindsey Graham has said as much. He said the donors have told him, don't bother to call us if you can't get this thing done. So there's sort of the proof there, if you will. What about Rob Johnson?
Yeah, it's interesting that this is not being done in secret. This is we have numerous sources who've told the same story to the journalists covering the legislative process, that this is a bill for donors.
But when Rob Johnson, then the Wisconsin senator, Republican, says that he can't vote for it because it's bad for small business and too generous to the wealthy and big corporations, is that just negotiating, or is that a real threat?
I think we shall see.
Yeah, okay.
Don't ask me to interpret the inner workings of the Republican.
Right. Well, your sense is that they're going to hold firm.
I think the pressure on them to hold on this one is very high, and so I mean, obviously the battle isn't over yet, this is a very high stakes battle.
So how can you, in the intervening week, with the Democrats shut out, how can the American people be told how they're going to get hosed by this thing? I mean, experts are warning that lowering tax rates for foreign earnings will encourage business to move abroad. That's goes counter to everything the Trump campaigned on. They also expect tax bills to lead to bigger trade deficits and drive up interest rates. I mean, there's so much in this that's going to be so destructive.
I think there are two basic points to be made here. One is that on balance, families are going to get hit, and that they, while they get a larger standard deduction, the loss of the personal exemption is really problematic and is going to hit families who take more of those deductions. So there is a big issue that seems to be very clearly the largest tax increase in the bill, and it's squarely aimed at the middle class. Second point to make is that the promise of this bill that it's going to generate economic growth is bogus. It's completely bogus. Corporations make investments when they believe that there is profit in the investment, not because the share of the resulting profits going to the federal government in taxes is going to be reduced by a certain amount. So yes, for whatever profits they currently have, and it's very substantial, they will get able to retain them. But the notion that this is going to increase the very anemic share of investment in the American economy or produce a higher growth rate is a bogus notion. It is a notion for which there's essentially no support in the empirical and the historical record. And so people need to understand that they're being sold a bill of goods whose purpose is to lower tax rates on big corporations for the sake of lowering tax rates on big corporations at the request of the, essentially, as I've said before, of the political donor class that controls big corporations. That is the essence of this bill, pure and simple.
And of course, when the super rich don't have to pay estate taxes, only a handful of families involved, that's a real flag, and you get deductions for private jets, but food stamps are cut.
You are going to cut against many institutions in this country. As we've mentioned, the state and local income taxes, which fund infrastructure investment and maintenance in the high-cost states. We've mentioned the mortgage interest deduction, which in principle getting rid of it would not necessarily be a terrible thing, but it's going to affect real estate values in the high-value states. And when we come to the estate and gift tax, getting rid of it is going to undermine the culture of philanthropy in this country, on which higher education, on which health care, on which cultural and religious institutions have come to depend over a century. So this is going to be an insidious effect. I should mention, too, by the way, that hidden in this bill, major tax increases for a small constituency that I happen to care about, which is graduate students, and particularly at state universities, where you have a lot of those students who are not particularly from high-income families and would not be able to pay the high tuition bills on their own. And they're going to see a number of small benefits which help make possible to maintain a robust structure of scientific and engineering graduate education in this country being cut out from under them in this bill. So there are lots of small pernicious things that are going to have significant effects down the road that are built into this bill for the sake, as we've, I think, said sufficiently, of satisfying the people who write the checks for the Republicans in the Congress.
But it is pretty bizarre. You'd want to punish PhDs and the most talented people in getting their doing their postgraduate work, quadrupling their taxes. Even you'd think the donors and the corporate heads who are looking for talent.
It doesn't make any difference to them.
Really?
Honestly, it doesn't.
Well, then this is some peculiar.
These are people who are sitting already on major cash flows, and they simply want the tax rate on those cash flows to be lowered. That's their interest.
Right.
What happens in the future to the companies that they happen to control at the moment, or to the country of which they're a part, is not part of the priority for this bill. It is not a priority for the people writing this bill. And that's clear from what they say themselves openly to the press, openly.
Right.
They've been told, don't come back if you don't pass the bill.
Right.
Don't expect to be funded in the next election if you don't pass this bill. That's what they're responding to. I mean, as a display, an unselfconscious display of political candor, this is really quite amazing.
So do you think, James Galbraith, do you think that they will have a little bump? I mean, I thought the most telling thing was when the economic advisor in the White House, Gary Cohn, was at a meeting with top CEOs, and the moderator asked the room to put up their hands if they thought this trickle-down thing would work and it would lead to a lot of jobs and economic growth. Hardly any hands came up. My sense is that that what's the con, a part of the con we've talked about in terms of this is basically the Republicans have to satisfy their donor class and con their voters into not noticing what's really happening, how they're going to get screwed.
Well, as for the economics fairy tale that lies behind this, this is all very much like the old story of the vaudeville man who runs out on stage and says to the audience, "Don't clap too loud. It's an old theater." This is a story we've heard many times before. We've had ample opportunity to test whether it was going to work, whether it was going to work for Reagan, whether it was going to work for George W. Bush. It didn't do so well, you know. And as time moves on and circumstances change, it's less and less persuasive, not more so. So the notion that we're going to see a sustained period of moving from 2.5% growth to 3-4% growth, which is required to make this policy defensible in some sense, required to underpin the claims that are being made about its effect on wages and so forth, is simply not credible. It's simply not credible. And if you were concerned about wages and living standards, then you would be strengthening the minimum wage. You'd be strengthening labor bargaining power. You would be strengthening Social Security, Medicare, and so forth, rather than trying to undermine them. And it's further true, I think, very clear that as soon as this bill is passed, we're going to see the deficit hawks returning, and it will. The next phase of this will not be a robust investment program in infrastructure, which we badly need, but yet another set of scare stories about how we need to cut Social Security and Medicare. Those are already clearly on the horizon once this particular scam has been passed into law. Hold on to your seat and hang on to your wallet. Right. Is all I can.
Well, this is the arsonist. Joining with the fire brigade or being the fire brigade. I mean, creating the problem and then saying, "I'm sorry, we have to solve the problem we created by, turning the screws on the
victims."
Well,
I think you're still betraying in a slightly optimistic view.
Well,
a body here that thinks in terms of national problems, but
right.
That is not the case.
I understand
that. We have a body here that thinks in terms of funding themselves through the next electoral
cycle. Right. No, it's clear where their fealty lies. But I think a part of the con, though, that I just wanted in closing here just to touch on, and that is that do you think you've already said that you think they'll get away with it because this the imperative to get something done is so great. But on the other hand, do you think they'll get away with having this sort of temporary boost to the economy for the couple of years, which is the way it's the bad stuff happens later? So are they going to basically con the average, particularly the Republican voters, into believing that things are going to will look good, and for the next couple of years, and then suddenly, all hell breaks loose.
Well, that's hard to judge. You can, of course, create conditions where you get a little extra boost to the GDP numbers in over a year or so. I'm not sure whether that will happen. I can't say that it won't, but that's not the this is a tax bill that creates a permanent reduction in the corporate tax rate, it cannot plausibly be sold as the source of a permanent increase in the economic growth rate, or even for a very long term, even medium term increase in the economic growth rate. So we can talk about short term political impact. We'll see what happens. I think some of the things that are going to happen to middle-class families are going to happen quite soon. So since the economy is being driven by consumption expenditure, by household expenditure, it's possible that you will not see an investment effect. You will see a consumption effect, and the net of this will not be positive for the growth rate at all. But I think we can wait and see how the details pan out in the time path of the actual legislation before we make a final judgment on that.
Well, James Galbraith, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who's chair in government business relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas Inequality Project and is the author of Inequality and Instability, a study of the world economy just before the Great Crisis, and Welcome to the Poison Chalice, the destruction of Greece and the future of Europe. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the slaughter in the Sinai that has outraged the Egyptian people and exposed the central fraud of General Sisi's military dictatorship, revealing that a military government cannot even provide basic security for its citizens.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth. And those pills make me...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sema Shahata, who's a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his latest book is Islamic Politics in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sema Shahata.
Thank you very much.
And this horrible slaughter that took place in the northern Sinai at a Sufi mosque is apparently it has the Egyptian public outraged. But do you agree with my assessment that this kind of exposes the central fraud of the General Sisi's military dictatorship, revealing that the military government cannot even provide basic security for its citizens?
Yes, I don't know if I would put it exactly that way. I mean, certainly we have an authoritarian regime in Egypt led by President Sisi, who, of course, was formerly the Minister of Defense and who ousted Egypt's first democratically elected president in the summer of 2013. And he's been very heavy-handed. And yes, they have had continuing crisis of security and terrorism in Sinai, and that has reached the mainland. And this is, of course, the most recent and most deadly incident of that. I mean, we've seen a Russian commercial jet, bombed out of the skies over Sinai several years ago. We've seen bombings of churches in Egypt proper, in Alexandria and in Cairo. We've seen over 1,000 members of the security forces been killed by these groups and so on. So there is a problem with security. It, of course, affects the whole country, but the primary targets have been in Sinai.
So when you mentioned Sisi's background, he was also, was he not, the head of military intelligence? And one of the main suspects, in fact, I believe he's Egypt's number one wanted person on the wanted list there is, this fellow that heads up an Al Qaeda brigade, Hesham Al Ashmawi, he's a former Egyptian special forces officer turned jihadist. What do we know about him?
Well, there have been a number of Egyptians who were in the security forces, not many, but some, who have, switched sides or have become extremists. We've had a number, one at least, who went to Syria and fought with ISIS. We also had a former member who ran for parliament and who failed in 2011,
who was radicalized and also then went to ISIS and went to Syria and carried out a suicide bombing. So there have been some of these cases. Of course, the information on the groups and even some of the individuals has been either incomplete or has been difficult for journalists to get information about because of the restrictions on journalism and so on, and also the deeming of these matters national security issues, being potentially subject to imprisonment and major fines if one kind of writes about them or speaks about them the wrong way. So, you know, that's an issue. I think the larger point that you're making is a very valid one, which is the military heavy-handed response to terrorism and to these groups has not worked. It hasn't worked with this regime by President Sisi. It didn't work under the Mubarak regime either. That's a very important point, and there's not a nuanced or a cadenced or approach to the issues that are involved, which are not simply security issues. They're political issues, certainly, of inclusion and exclusion, of torture and human rights abuses. And they're economic and social issues having to do with marginalization or neglect of an important part of the country, the Sinai and so on.
Sure. Well, following a suicide bombing in southern Sinai in 2004, the Mubarak government apparently arrested 3,000 people, tortured many of them, took women and children as hostages, those related to the suspects, and apparently they've alienated the Bedouin tribes who know the terrain. The military have lost 1,000 members since 2014, but for some reason or other, Sisi can't work with the Bedouins and the local people, and the reason being what?
Well, there's several reasons. One is, you know, in a very general level, there is a kind of condescending attitude towards the Bedouins and the indigenous residents of Sinai by many Egyptians, including the security forces, maybe particularly the military, that doesn't see them as full citizens, and that in some cases question their loyalty to the country. And in other cases, view them with great deal of suspicion, sometimes animosity, having to do with involvement in gray economy or illegal trade and so on. So I think all of those issues, you know, are kind of foundational. And then, as you implied or mentioned, you know, or as I said earlier, Sinai has been marginalized, has been neglected, and particularly the areas of Sinai that are not tourist destinations by either the Egyptians on the mainland or the international tourist economy. I mean, you can go to Sharm el-Sheikh, for example, or some of the hotels located in the Sinai in the south on the water and have a five-star life. And all of the major hotels are there, you know, the Marriott and the Sheratons and the Hiltons and so on. Whereas if you go to other towns that are not part of the tourist economy, that have not seen major investment, you won't find even adequate schools or adequate hospitals or adequate infrastructure, as it may be. And so the Sinai has been marginalized economically and socially for decades, even before Sisi, as you mentioned, President Mubarak in 2004 and the heavy-handed, and that's just one example. And then when you add on to that, the heavy-handed approach, you know, that goes beyond the rule of law in dealing with terrorism, collective punishment, and so on, you get the situation you are today, we have today.
So the victims, 305 killed, 27 of whom, of them being children, at a Sufi mosque. Egypt has about 15 million Sufis. The attackers had Islamic State Daesh flags. That's the assumption. It looks as though while they're being defeated in Syria and Iraq, they're you know, strengthening their hold in the Sinai, and that's in itself is a pretty scary prospect. But let's talk about that religious ideology. I mean, you know, when these psychotics running around in pickup trucks, it's perhaps too generous to refer to it as an ideology, but it does seem to have a consistency here going back to Saudi Wahhabism, and that is this hatred towards the Sufis from these kind of Wahhabi-type hardliners. The leader of al-Naba, one of the group's religious leaders, said, our primary focus lies in the war against polytheism and apostasy, and of those, Sufism, sorcery, and divination are the greatest threats. And they apparently, they on video, they beheaded a couple of Sufi elders to reinforce their point. Why are the Sufis the first apparent target of these Islamic fundamentalists?
Right. Well, you know, they are seen as deviating from Islam, seen as holding others either as mediators or in the place of God, of course, and the Daesh or, you know, Islamic State individuals and so on are extremists who have a kind of not only a literal but a extreme anti-tolerant version of Islam in which Muslims, many Muslims, the majority of Muslims who don't practice and hold the views that they hold, and particularly the Shia, right, as well as Sufis, as well as I mentioned, kind of, you know, moderate Muslims and so on, if that's an appropriate term, that's a problematic term, are viewed as being outside of Islam and as viewed as being legitimate targets of violence and so on. And so Sufis in particular, who could be seen as being mystical or who could be seen as not practicing a kind of rigid, literal interpretation of Islam as being mystical, as kind of venerating other individuals who occupy a place between people and God, that is viewed as almost a kind of apostasy, you know, not believing in the monotheism of God and so on. So
right.
They are deemed unbelievers.
Right. Having too much fun, right? Dancing and carrying. I mean, and that seems to be the idea that, you know, only the extreme austerity is acceptable. By the way, I was struck by the piece by Tom Friedman in the New York Times about his long interview with MBS, the Crown Prince.
It received a lot of attention, yeah.
Yeah, it raises the issues we're talking about here, the malignant influence of Saudi Wahhabism around the world and on these radical movements. And MBS is telling Tom Friedman that that he wants to get rid of all that stuff and return to the real intention of the Prophet and the book, going back to the real history of the Prophet in terms of having theater and no restrictions between the sexes and all of this austere stuff that the Wahhabis have brought about. Tom Friedman, of course, was very influential. His support for the Iraq War, I think, in many ways, gave liberals and centrists in this country permission to get aboard that folly. What's your sense about his reporting on the intentions of MBS to rein in Wahhabism?
Well, I think, like many people, my view of the article that he wrote about Mohammed bin Salman and Saudi Arabia and their reform efforts is that it's incredibly naive. And in fact, there have been a number of high-profile individuals from American think tanks and so on in Washington and others who have been flown out to Saudi Arabia and have drank the Kool-Aid and have believed the mythology that Mohammed bin Salman has been offering with regards to reform in the country, with regards to those individuals who are in the five-star Ritz-Carlton prison in Riyadh, to anti-corruption efforts, to pro-women, and to his, you know, policies in the region, when in fact, Mohammed bin Salman has been incredibly heedless, and that's to put it kind of politely, irresponsible, and has caused death and suffering to thousands and thousands in terms of his efforts. All we need to look at is the misguided misadventure in Yemen and what that has caused, you know, in terms of, you know, record numbers of cholera, potential famine in Yemen, well over 10,000 deaths U.S. ammunition, U.S. weapons used in the destruction, the obliteration of the infrastructure of that country. Not only that, you know, I mean, we could look at the heightened, needlessly heightened tensions with Iran and so on, or the GCC crisis that he and the United Arab Emirates are behind, you know, pitting Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain versus Qatar, and what that has resulted in, right? I mean, it's the biggest right. diplomatic Arab, inter-Arab dispute since Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. So I think, you know, I think that piece is fluff, propaganda, and incredibly naive with regard to how Mohammed bin Salman has been positioned by Mr. Friedman. And of course, those of us who work on the Middle East don't take, you know, Thomas Friedman's writings very seriously. Most of it is based on his discussions with a few taxi cab drivers or elites that he has met in five-star hotels, or in this case, despots and dictators. So, but that being said, though, he has a tremendous amount of influence, as you mentioned, and that's quite worrying.
Well, of course, the intention behind the, first of all, Jared Kushner, who's his MBS's buddy, tried to shake down the Qataris for money to bail out his terrible investment with the $1.2 billion balloon payment due at the end of the next year, which he can't pay. There's a subtext there. But the real intention of MBS's and MBZ, their blockade of Qatar is to shut down Al Jazeera. Well, how can you be a reformer or say you're a reformer and want to shut down the press that is about the only breath of fresh air in that region?
Yeah, that's one of, that's certainly one of the top intentions. And another general intention is that they view Qatar and Qatar's orientation towards the Arab uprisings in 2011, towards political Islam, towards free media, for example, as being threatening to their regimes. And in fact, this gets to a larger point, which, again, flies in the face of what Mr. Friedman was trying to argue. Saudi Arabia has been the biggest obstacle to reform in the region for decades, and particularly after the Arab uprisings. They have mounted what we call a kind of counter-revolution, and they, of course, sent forces over the King Fahd Causeway into Bahrain in March of 2011 to help put down that uprising in Bahrain and so on that initially was demanding equal citizenship for all, freedom and liberty and so on. It wasn't sectarian-based. They've also, of course, been against the democracy and democratization elsewhere in the region, in Egypt and in Tunisia, actually, you know, at the time of the uprising against Zain al-Abidine bin Ali and so on. So they are really the antithesis of democracy and freedom and equality in the region. So that makes Thomas Friedman's piece even more, you know, difficult to deal with.
Well, I thank you for joining us. You know, obviously we need to do a follow-up here. Sisi unleashing the Air Force and showing on Egyptian state TV pictures of bombing to stirring music. It looks like a complete show with very little substance, and I'm sure, you know, not a lot of damage to this growing insurgent movement. So we need to stay in touch, if you don't mind.
Happy to speak to you in the future.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Samer Shahata, who's a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and formerly a professor at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his latest book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.